Hey, On Demand listener, this is Meg Malone, VPR's digital producer. Just letting you know that this podcast has been edited for clarity and brevity. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm.
3, 2, 1.
That's the sound of drones racing in Bolton Valley back in 2016 during International Drone Day. That's right, drone racing. It's not Star Wars. It's an increasingly common way for drone operators to show off their stuff and have some fun. Drones are being used in a lot of interesting applications, from mapping industrial and commercial projects to following wildlife relatively unobtrusively, to getting into dangerous spaces to see what's going on when people shouldn't go in themselves. And then there's the wedding photography, landscape shots, aerial foliage tours, tourism marketing, ski videos, and on and on. While the federal rules around drones were updated in 2016, there are more rules being crafted and tweaked, and our guests today are working with the FAA on what makes sense to allow increased commercial and private use without falling afoul of aviation safety regulations and personal privacy concerns. No matter where you fall on that spectrum, you're going to want to know more about how Vermonters are actually using drones in some interesting applications. So let's talk about it. Back with us today is Jarlath O'Neill Dunn, director of UVM's Spatial Analysis Laboratory, where he works with UVM's Unmanned Aircraft Systems team. Jarlath, it's nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you, Jane. A real pleasure to be here.
I feel like we do this every couple of years, and every couple of years there's more to talk about, more ways drones are being used, more ways both hobbyists and people who are using them for professional applications are getting drones into the mix. And so it's always neat to hear, you know, what's new in the drone world. But before we get into that, can you give us the scope? You know, how just physically, how big and how small can a drone be and still be a drone?
Well, we've got everything from the military drones that a lot of us are familiar with, and these can be very large systems that are on par with traditional aircraft. And then we have down to these micro drones, right? And you or your children may have these things, and really they can be down to the size of almost your fingernail. So really a broad range of the size of drone technology.
Now, I have not seen any one of my ilk or my children's ilk with a drone the size of a fingernail. That sounds like it's probably an expensive drone as opposed to the like fist size ones that, you know, regular people might buy for $60.
Yes, and drones are a broad range of prices too. So, for example, you can go and get a drone that's really nice for, you know, $60, $70 that you can fly around inside your house. And then there's drones we have at UVM that cost tens of thousands. And that's simply because they allow us to do high accuracy mapping.
Why would you want to fly a drone around your house just for fun?
I think so. I am not someone who flies drones around my house, but and many people who have had them stuck in their hair probably would also agree they're not fun. But, you know, if you're young, what a great way to enjoy yourself.
I can attest that some dogs do not like drones that fly around the house either. But so is a drone, I mean, so like I'm a child of the 80s, and when I was a kid, there used to be people who would go out to the ball field or to an old airport that was no longer used and fly remote-controlled planes. Are those drones? Is there any difference between those, you know, remote-controlled planes of the 80s and the drones of today besides technology?
I think fundamental, we'd say that both of those are flying machines in the airspace. The difference is that back in those days, it required a much higher level of skill to operate those type of remote-controlled aircraft. Nowadays, thanks to advances in the technology, really anyone can go out and buy a drone and have some degree of success flying that thing.
So it's actually easier today than it was.
It's easier today. The technology has improved. There's all types of controls and stabilization, everything from GPS technology to the gyros inside these drones.
So back in 2016, when the Obama administration updated and changed the rules around flying drones, the FAA said that it thought there would be potentially as many as 3.5 million small hobbyist drones in the airspace by 2021 and up to 1.6 million commercial drones in use by 2021. And those numbers are a little bit old, so they may have updated them since, but that is a lot of drones flying around in the airways. And that's just the United States, I think.
Absolutely. And it's a huge challenge because when we want to integrate this new technology into our national airspace, especially if you're an organization like the FAA, which controls and governs and regulates the airspace, you can imagine the potential headaches you have now, where traditionally you just had piloted aircraft and a huge barrier to entry.
And those hobbyists from the 80s and the, you know, on the ball field.
Yeah, exactly. There was a barrier to entry there. They were typically part of a model aircraft club. And now it's just you going down to your local electronics store or placing an order online. and suddenly you've got something that you can put up in the sky.
So is that a problem for you? I mean, you work with UVM's unmanned aircraft systems team, so you're flying drones. Do you ever encounter other drones that you're like, wait a minute, what the heck?
We have. We just had an incident a few weeks ago where we were actually shooting some video on the UVM campus. That is controlled airspace because we're near the Burlington Airport. It's also, there's regulations at UVM that govern how you fly drones, and we had a drone acting erratically and flying over people, and so a bunch of things there that pilot of that drone shouldn't have been doing. We don't know where that pilot was, and that forced us actually to bring our drone in and land it at the time because we were worried about a potential air-to-air collision.
Which, if your drones are in the tens of thousands of dollars, would be more of a problem than perhaps somebody's $100
drone. That would be a bit of a budget hit for us.
But isn't one of the rules, the FAA rules about flying drones, is that still, and this is, you know, contentious in some ways, but that the operator needs to be able to have physical eyes on the drone or have somebody else who this operator is working with, where that maybe they're talking by walkie-talkie, but that person, so somebody always has to have eyes on the drone.
That's correct. Unless you have a waiver from the FAA, you have to maintain what's called line of sight. So the operator has to be able to see that drone, and that's unaided, not with binoculars or anything else. You have to be able to see that drone as the operator.
So do you believe that the drone operator in question, when you were having an issue, could see the drone? You couldn't see the operator.
We couldn't see the operator, but they were doing a number of things that were unsafe, both in the way they were flying and operating the drones over large crowds, right? If a drone falls out of the sky because it suffers some type of failure, if it interacts with a human being on the ground, even if it's a small drone, dropping from 100 to 200 feet could cause some significant damage and perhaps even death in certain cases.
So, you know, that's one of the, I think, irritations that people feel. We've talked in years past about people worried about drones spying on them when they're unawares. And that's hard to do because drones make noise. They fly pretty low. Usually you can see or hear a drone that's near you, that's in your personal airspace. But there are occasions where somebody may be flying a drone. The drone, you can hear it, you can see it, but you can't see the person. You can't see where the drone is coming from. You don't know why they're using it. And so you don't have a lot of recourse to figure out either what's going on or to say to somebody, knock it off. And Joseph in Burlington wrote in to say, I've experienced drones flying and hovering over my property. I consider it not only annoying due to sound, but an invasion of my privacy. Unlike aircraft, there's no visible registration or identification of a drone, and no way to contact the owner or report the drone to authorities. So, first of all, you know, is that a problem? And then Joseph wants to know if he's allowed to get an air pellet gun and shoot it down.
Well, I'll preface my comments, Jane, by saying that I'm not a lawyer and I'm certainly not Joseph's lawyer in this case. But if you do want to take action on an aircraft, keep in mind that the FAA governs airspace. So whether you're shooting at a drone or you're shooting an aircraft, you could be running afoul of federal regulations. But drones can certainly be a nuisance. They have some really great capabilities. We're seeing people deliver medical supplies. We're using it to get in and do inspections on bridges that would be difficult or dangerous for people. But then when it's flying over your property or maybe you're out at Waterbury Reservoir enjoying the day, and you hear this buzzing overhead, absolutely right, that's a nuisance. I would say on the privacy front, just go to Google Maps and have a look at the imagery of your property. And if you live in Burlington, Joseph, you've got your property, you can look at it from multiple angles and three dimensions. So unfortunately, the ship has sailed in terms of being able to preserve privacy of what your backyard looks like. But I can understand the annoyance that drones pose to many residents in the state.
But that question of privacy, even if the ship has sailed, if the perception among people is that somehow drones are doing something different than, you know, the satellites are, which may not be true, couldn't that influence public policy in a way that's more restrictive perhaps than you or others might like?
It absolutely could, but I would argue that we want to regulate the type of data that we're collecting. So if I have a webcam mounted on my property pointing into Joseph's property, or if I'm using a telephotic lens with great resolution, or I have a camera mounted on a drone, I would say all of these are equal invasions of his privacy. And we want to look at that holistically, not just say because it's a drone, we need to take different action in that case.
Can you just give us an example of what drones do? You mentioned bridges, you mentioned some of the ways that they're being used, but just by way of example, what your team has done just in the last couple of months?
Sure, absolutely. We were out mapping last week. We were helping a local company that has a gravel quarry, and we were assisting them gaining a volumetric inventory of all their gravel piles. That's something that traditionally has been expensive and time-consuming. The surveyor that they had worked with said they might have to go to an out-of-state organization, so we're working with us. We can go ahead and fly that property in the morning and by the afternoon have the 3D volumetric measurements to them, something that before may have taken days or weeks to accomplish.
What else?
So other activities that we're doing, we're really engaged still on the disaster response side and looking at how we can effectively integrate these technologies to help organizations, whether it's FEMA or the local fire department, get in there after these disasters and assess to help speed the recovery, locate people that may need evacuation, and also document the situation in case we need recovery funds to go to that community.
My town is among the many that has a volunteer fire department. Are you hoping or thinking that someday in the future, even, you know, volunteer departments, that all these departments that are working in conjunction with one another and independently will have drones that they use as part of their first responses?
I think that's very realistic. And thanks to Senator Leahy and his team, we're working with the FAA right now to look at how we can integrate drones into these complicated disaster response activities. So maybe your town just has a fire in a building and it's just that fire that's the focus. And it's just your fire department putting up a drone, but we can imagine a type of a serious flood along the order of Tropical Storm Irene. And maybe the local fire department has a drone up, but the media has drones up. We might have a search and rescue helicopter from the National Guard. We could have medevac deliveries happening via drones. We could have medevacs to recover injured people. We've got so many things that could be happening. Even the kids down the street who want to broadcast that on YouTube, suddenly that situation gets very complicated. And that's where the FAA is looking to us and our consortium for guidance.
And what are you saying to them? I mean, if that were to be the case where there are, you know, 15 drones in a small airspace, and most of them, if not all of them, are doing totally legitimate work and should have a right to be there, What's the order of priority, or who should be in charge, and how would that be coordinated? Because this is not science fiction. This is something that you see in the near future.
Oh, absolutely. And we've seen this happen with forest fires where they've been trying to do the drops of the fire retardant and someone puts up a drone and suddenly they shut down the fire retardant drops because they're concerned about the drones interacting with manned aircraft. Coming back to sort of another Tropical Storm Irene event in Vermont, we're going to need to go beyond the current regulations. Right now, as long as it's not controlled airspace, meaning you're not near an airport or you're not over a military base, basically you can fly your drone below 400 feet. But once we have multiple drones operating in that airspace and we have a medevac helicopter or search and rescue helicopter perhaps operating in the airspace, we probably need those drones to be able to talk to each other. We need a way to coordinate. And right now we've got limited technological options to do that. And they're very challenging to employ on drones because a lot of these technology options require a lot of power. And if you looked at drones, like you mentioned, these can be pretty small and they may not have the power to broadcast their location to other aircraft, things that we could do with traditional piloted aircraft.
So do you think that's coming? I mean, is that going to be one of the facets of drone technology that's pretty common as a way for drones to talk to one another?
That's right. We're going to need a way to communicate their location, and that's both from a safety perspective, but also if we're all out there, we want to make sure in a disaster that we're not duplicating each other's efforts.
I mean, we can't always get through emergency situations without signal interference on, radio signals. Are we really going to be involving drones as well and being able to coordinate that?
I think it's going to be very, very challenging. And a lot of these technologies that may work well perhaps out in the Midwest where things are flat, you just get into Vermont and we all know driving around, we can watch our cell phone signals disappear. And I should say, ideally, not while we're driving, we shouldn't be watching that, right? But you get in these challenging areas. And so for some of these technologies that work very well on aircraft when they're flying at 10,000 feet, they may not work well when you're 300 feet behind a mountain.
You know, Jarlath, you mentioned that some of the drones can be as small as a thumbnail. What are those small drones being used for?
So we're seeing some of these what are often called micro drones, not just to fly around your house, and antagonize your dog, but we're seeing companies use them, for example, to get in spaces and do things like inspect pipes, right? So maybe there's a crack in a small pipe. How would you get in there? But it's very, very difficult to operate those drones outside. We've got GPS, right? We've got a lot of technology that we can employ. As soon as you get into these closed environments, that goes away. And often you might also need a power source. If you've got a tiny little drone in a tiny little battery, both the light source and the propulsion systems aren't going to last for an extended period of time.
Hard to imagine having line of sight as well.
Exactly. But once you're inside a pipe, you're not in controlled airspace, so you're in the clear.
Do you foresee, sort of biomedical approaches with drones as well? I mean, I know certainly today, there's a lot of ways that medical professionals can map what's going on in your body and use other kinds of cameras to get through. But could you see drones, or are they already somehow being used inside our bodies?
I think that could be a possibility. I think we see people swallowing things like microchips. I don't know if we'll want things actually moving around inside our bodies with propulsion systems.
Unmanned. But,
exactly. But, you know, who knows, right?
But that does seem like the thing of, if not science fiction, at least a little farther into the future than some of the other stuff you're talking about.
It could be. I think where we'll really see the movement on the medical front that we're already seeing by some organizations in the developing world is the delivery of medical supplies. And this is really exciting, particularly when you need to get life-saving drugs between villages that would be very expensive to do by helicopter, in which there's no landing strips for planes. Now you can have drones and these leapfrog systems that go to an area. Perhaps there's a charging site there. They can be recharged, drop off their medical supplies, and then be sent back to the other locations.
Yeah, I mean, I think people may have in mind some of the questions about Amazon dropping off packages via drone. And there are really strict regulations on that kind of commercial use of drones. But something like medical supplies, would that have an easier path, or does that have an easier path?
They're still going to fall under the same FAA regulation. So I think in any of those cases, it's not going to be an easy path, particularly when we get into our major urbanized areas that already have controlled airspace where there's airports. There's a risk of that drone, if it falls out of the sky, hitting someone or landing on a vehicle. That's where I think the major challenges are going to be.
We're talking today about drones and learning more about their applications from Jarlath O'Neill-Dunn, who directs UVM Spatial Analysis Laboratory. And when we come back, we'll also be joined by Steve Mermelstein, who's the founder and director of photography for Vermont Drone. And we're going to talk more about drone racing. We're going to talk about some of the other ways that drones are being used and some of the areas where there's maybe not controversy, but some tension around how to make rules that make sense, that still allow for technological innovation and job creation, and more about what's happening here in Vermont. And let's bring Steve Mermelstein into the conversation. Steve is the founder and director of photography at Vermont Drone, which is a business that deploys drones for aerial and underwater photography, for data collection, and for other things. And he's also the vice president of the Drone User Group, a community group that gives feedback to the FAA on how drones are being used. Steve, nice to have you joining the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, you know, I have to admit that when I think about drone photography, you know, I picture marketing photos for when a home goes on sale, or maybe an Instagram influencer, you know, taking a video of him or herself on top of a cliff, like, look at how, you know, special and interesting I am. But there are also other practical uses for drone photography and some different ones that you're using. Can you talk a little bit about what you do with drone photography?
Sure. You know, we've been filmmakers, photographers for a very long time, and always wanted to, you know, be able to put our camera in places that we physically couldn't. And so, you know, we basically use drones as a tripod that we can place anywhere. We can place that camera anywhere in any space. And so it's just a way of getting shots that you can't get, you know, physically as a person that is unable to fly, you know. So it really expands our abilities, you know, to get different angles and better tell our story that we're doing with our filmmaking or pictures. But, you know, we're primarily do like YouTube videos for businesses and all types of things. It may not always be, you know, 100% drone photography. You know, it's often only a third of it is actually using the drones, and the rest is more traditional photography. But it's become such a important part of the storytelling.
You know, wedding photographers have complained for the last decade or so that every time they're trying to photograph a wedding, there are all these people on their cell phones also taking pictures of the wedding and getting in the way. Do you foresee that being an issue with drones? Like, you're trying to do a drone shot of something and all of these other hobbyist drones with other cameras are up there crowding your space?
Not really. I don't think that's really, you know, an actual problem that will exist. You know, most people that get into it recreationally are really just interested in flying low to the ground, you know, and exploring spaces maybe, or racing, or doing other types of, you know, it's more or less, it's still model aircraft activity. And, you know, the people that do this are very responsible, and, you know, for the most part, you get these bad actors that make stories every once in a while, but those people that are flying like that, their drones, frankly, don't last very long. And so they get out of the hobby very quick, you know, and so, you know, they're going to be put in a tree very quickly.
You know, Charlotte O'Neill done one of the other rules that we've talked about before, and I think it's actually an FAA rule, but you're not supposed to fly your little hobby drone over a stadium or, you know, a fish concert or anything like that. You're actually, it's dangerous to do that over a crowded field full of people.
That's absolutely right, Jane. I mean, if you think about these drones, although they're incredibly reliable, all it takes is one of these little quadcopters for the propeller to fail, and you could have this little device that's maybe 1 or 2 pounds, but coming down 200-300 feet from the sky and hitting someone, and that would have very negative consequences.
So somebody like Steve's company would get a special, not a waiver necessarily, but like a special permission to actually photograph an event, and that would be the only drone allowed in the sky in that case.
Well, no, it wouldn't be the only drone allowed in the sky. In Steve's case, when he's out there, especially if he's flying not over people, he's definitely in the clear. And if he even wants to fly over people, if he has their permission to do so, he's allowed to. When you get into wanting to film parades or something like that, then you need a special, actually a waiver from the FAA, a waiver from the regulations. And we've seen some companies doing some very innovative things right now. A lot of waivers are being granted for these little parachutes that are mounted on drones. So if that drone suffers a failure, the operator can deploy the parachute and that drone will then glide to the ground. And instead of hitting you and hurting you, it'll bump into you and you'll feel a little bit annoyed.
So Sean wrote in to say it's a little frustrating to hear this expert talk about how irresponsible non-commercial operators are. In reality, the vast majority of hobbyists fly safely and responsibly. Also, the responsible hobbyists are just as frustrated by irresponsible drone flying, if not more. Charlotte, I didn't hear you saying, you know, all hobbyist drone operators are irresponsible, but can you clarify your thoughts on that?
Oh, absolutely. And I would think it's, you know, it's people like Steve and his user groups out there that are just such a positive force in the community for helping people operate responsibly. And what we see out there is, as Steve said, the vast majority of users are operating really responsibly. They're following the regulations. They're using apps like Before You Fly to ensure they're not operating in controlled airspace. And I'll just echo what Steve said, that, you know, chances are if you're flying irresponsibly, right, your drone's going to run into something, hopefully a tree or a building and not a person at some point in time. It'll suffer those negative consequences. But we still see these incidents happen out there. And those are the incidents that end up on the front page of a website or the front page of a newspaper and command the greatest attention.
Steve, I understand that there's some talk about potentially requiring drone operators of all kinds to pass a test, you know, to sort of take a class like you would driver's ed, I guess, in order
exactly.
to be able to fly a drone. Do you think that's a good idea? I mean, that would weed out people who aren't doing it responsibly.
I definitely like the idea. I just think the implementation that Congress mandated on the FAA is not that sane and or well thought out. It's more of a knee-jerk reaction from the manned pilots union, you know, in response to the technology. But, you know, because what's happening is, you know, this test is probably going to be in force before the end of this year. That's what the FAA is hoping. They might not make that deadline, though. But it's going to require every single person, even your daughter, you know, who just received a Barbie drone, to go online, watch videos about air traffic and, you know, reading air charts and reading the weather bulletins and a lot of information that a nine-year-old couldn't process, let alone, have the attention span to sit through and listen to, you know, and then take a test, you know, basically criminalizing a very benign activity of a little tiny drone that isn't capable of flying at any height and posing any danger to anyone. So it's kind of silly that there hasn't been an exemption for the drones that we all know that science tells us are absolutely safe and don't pose a risk to aircraft or to people. So it's kind of like silly that we're criminalizing these benign uses that, you know, are actually training our future pilots, getting people interested in science and engineering. You know, it's kind of a very overreaction to a non-existent problem.
What do you think, Jarlath?
Yeah, I agree with Steve. I think with regulations, we have to be careful. On one hand, we want to make sure that our airspace is safe. On the other hand, we want to make sure that we're not hampering either the development of the next generation of technology professionals or hampering the use of this technology in a way that could save lives or just perhaps even save government agencies money in the way they carry out their daily duties.
Let's go to Stuart, who's calling in from Walcott. Hi, Stuart.
Hey, how you doing? I had heard that Dubai was using drones for taxi service where they would actually come and pick you up unmanned and bring you to where you're going. Wasn't sure whether that was true or not. And also I'd heard that there's drones that you can fly in that, you know, for about $50,000, you can purchase your own. Is that, wanted to see if these were actual facts.
And Stuart, when you say purchase your own to fly in, you mean like a drone, but you would actually sit in it?
Yeah, you climb inside of it.
Jarlath, do you know anything about that?
I'm not familiar with those cases. I don't know if Steve's laid down $50,000 for a drone that you can fly. And I think there's going to be a lot of technological issues around that, you know, the Uber and Lyfts of the sky, if you will.
Yeah.
In Vermont, we've got an innovative company here, Beta Technologies, which is developing a lot of this VTOL, vertical takeoff and landing, electric-powered solutions that I think will lend itself to these types of services. But there's a lot of challenges to implementing that in the sky right now. It's even more challenging, I think, than autonomous driving vehicles.
Steve, have you shelled out the money to buy one yourself?
I haven't. You know, but you know, as soon as a person is in these vehicles, you know, a drone is really an unmanned aircraft. So as soon as you have a person in it, it's no longer a drone, and it's really general aviation to some degree.
Even if the operator is on the ground.
Correct.
So, Steve, I want you to tell us a little bit about drone racing, because one of the things that I didn't know is that Vermont has the first permanent indoor drone racing course in the country, which sounds so cool. Can you tell us about it?
Sure, absolutely. So with the help of Generator, we got the funds to create this permanent indoor racing course.
And let me just stop you for people who don't know. Generator is like the makerspace in Burlington and an innovation space where interesting things are happening. And so Generator is part of this drone racing course setup and implementation.
Correct. Exactly. And so, you know, the first Tuesday and fourth Tuesday of every month in the evening, we have an open house that people can come and watch the races, participate, and possibly participate if you have the gear. And, you know, we just have these, you know, drone meetups too during those times. So if you're just interested in learning more or talking about drones, you can come to those. And it's really fun. It's, you know, think of like the Nintendo game. I'm mind blanking on the name. But it's like you're flying first person view through these lit up gates and other gates on the ground and at different elevations. And you know, you're seeing first person view what the drone is seeing, and you're trying to navigate this course, which twists and turns and it's not easy. So, you know, but you're flying these little tiny drones that basically fit in the size of your hand, and they're very quiet, but they're very fast. And it just allows you to experience flight, you know, as if you're a bird, but you're navigating this difficult course.
I see. So you're actually wearing the goggles, so you're seeing that first-person view of what your drone is doing rather than trying to just watch from your stationary vantage point and fly your drone that way.
Exactly. And it really does pull you into, like, you know, the experience of flight.
And do you do it?
I like to race more for fun. You know, I don't like the pressure of racing, so I personally don't, even though I organized and started these races.
So you're more on the sidelines and then racing. Yeah, that's the way I used to run cross country. It was not competitive, but enjoyed the idea of it.
Right.
Let's go to Ray, who's calling in from Montgomery. Hi, Ray. You're on the air. Go right ahead.
I just wanted to call in with a different perspective about drones and model aircraft. I've been flying model aircraft for probably over 20 years, and unfortunately, the FAA, as part of the reauthorization bill, have essentially banned any of our model aircraft flying above 400 feet now. Now, these aren't what you think of as a drone. These are aircraft that you have to control through line of sight. They don't have any GPS input. They don't have any, you know, stability built into them, unlike these quadcopters. And the big issue is now I've got probably 6 or 7 aircraft, and I can't guarantee that they will stay below 400 feet. I've got 2 sailplanes with over a 4-meter wingspan, and routinely I was flying them in uncontrolled airspace, what's called Class G, without any problems. And yet now, all those aircraft are essentially grounded because of these new FAA regulations. And I might add that I'm a retired airline captain with type ratings on Boeings and Airbus aircraft, so I'm very aware of different airspace regulations and staying away from any full-size aircraft, and I've done this safely for years, and yet it seems that the lobbying by these commercial drone entities have really skewed the FAA regulations in their favor, and they've killed, I think, a lot of different forms of model aircraft flying. And I'll
Ray, that's interesting. Let me put that to Jarlath O'Neill Dunn, because you know you think a lot about these issues, and one of the concerns that many people have about drone regulations is that they are a little too restrictive. And here's Ray saying, you know, for what he does, which is not the same as some of the other drone stuff that we've been talking about, the rules about drones have really impacted his hobby.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, Ray. You know, and I'm not here to speak on behalf of the FAA or any other government organization, but we went from a situation over a decade ago, right, when there were these model aircraft clubs, right, a high sense of tradecraft and responsibility. And I think from the FAA's perspective, then we've seen this explosion of drones where suddenly there's the ability of millions of people to put up flying aircraft. And so some of these rules that have come out don't really address the complexities of the landscape, right? And so we've sectioned off the airspace into these compartments, which work for some users and provide some measure of safety, but clearly don't work for you. And hopefully in the future, you know, we'll have technologies that maybe allow us greater flexibility of the airspace, but I can understand your frustration, and it's extremely challenging on multiple levels.
Well, and both Steve and Jarlath are involved in, you know, offering communication and advice to authorities as these rules get changed and rearranged. You know, Jarlath, this is still something that's happening as we speak. New technology is coming out, new ideas for applications for drones. I mean, we didn't even get into with Steve the underwater drone technology and drone photography. What do you see as the future in terms of how this might be able to be a part of economic development for the state, and how more people then are going to have to be able to learn and get into it?
Well, I think groups like what Steve is doing is fantastic. He's helping to train people that can fly drones in tricky situations through drone racing that we'll need for bridge inspection. On our end, we're out in the schools. We're working with 4-H. We're worked with Upward Bound this summer to target first-generation students. I think what's really great about drone technology, it's a local technology. We don't want to fly in an expensive company from Ohio to map Vermont, right? We can do that locally here, and I think we at UVM have a role to play in that economic development and the great work that Steve and Generator do and making this technology accessible to others.
Steve, what about from your perspective? How can or should people get into it, and how do you see it in the future?
I, you know, if you're interested in getting into it, start with that inexpensive $60 toy drone and just practice with it a lot. And it really becomes very, you know, with a little bit of practice, it becomes very easy. And then once you have those skills down, you can fly any type of drone.
And we'll have links up for more information about the drone racing and other ways to get involved or at least read more at vpr.org. You can click on Vermont Edition. Steve Mermelstein is the director and founder of photography at Vermont Drone, a business that deploys drones for aerial and underwater photography. And he's vice president of the Drone User Group, which is a community group that gives feedback to the FAA. Jarlath O'Neill Dunn directs UVM's Spatial Analysis Laboratory, and he works with UVM's Unmanned Aircraft Systems team. Steve and Jarlath, thank you both very much for talking drones with us.
My pleasure.